Thank you. The Soviet space dogs are on the short list of historical animals in the little introduction, probably. They are among the most celebrated and tragic characters of the Cold War. Laika, the first living being to orbit the Earth, Belka and Strelka, the first to return alive after orbital flight, and Zvezdochka, the final dog to fly before Yuri Gagarin became the first man in space, all of these dogs were global celebrities. People around the world perceived them as pioneers and scouts, as well as victims. Their ability to survive in space provided a clear bridge to the advent of human space travel, a connection made stronger by the long intertwined histories of humans and the oldest domesticate. And of course, the famous space dogs were just the visible representatives of the dozens of dogs who were used to develop the manned space flight program from the early 50s, when the first rocket dogs were sent aloft into the upper atmosphere, until 1966, when two dogs spent 22 days aboard the Cosmos 110, setting the canine record for space flight. So the development of the Soviet Union's manned spaceflight program brought humans and dogs together in ways that confounded conventional models of human-dog interaction, whether that be as companion species or as experimental organisms in the heyday of behaviorism. The researchers who worked with the formerly stray dogs brought an array of expectations to the laboratory. Powerful, often contradictory emotions informed their relationships with the dogs, on whom they projected their own aspirations and fears. The humans also brought with them a raft of assumptions about the differences and similarities between dogs and people. For their part, the dogs displayed a complex spectrum of fortitude, fear, affection, and resistance in their interactions with their handlers and in their response to the training to which they were subjected. So what I'd like to do in this talk is focus on how key emotions were to the relationships that constituted the work of the Space Dog Laboratory, and I'm particularly interested in how the emotions of individual dogs helped them to survive. So we learned yesterday that emotions are psychological phenomena, right, that help with behavioral management and control. And while there is disagreement about the extent to which animals experience emotions and how closely animal emotions compare to those of humans, a significant body of scientific writing going back to Darwin demonstrates that animals, including dogs, do have emotions. Like the Soviet scientists who trained the space dogs, scholars such as Mark Bekoff and Franz de Waal understand emotions as an evolutionary adaptation that allows for flexibility in behavior to avoid harm and to communicate with others. Emotions are more individual and subjective than hardwired responses, and their variability among individuals suggests just how complex they are and how linked they are to subjectivity and how hard it is to unpack them from other contested concepts such as personality, mood, and motivation. For dogs and humans, emotions serve as a kind of social glue. They are essential for developing and maintaining bonds and community, both among conspecifics, but also in mixed species group. Indeed, one of the most striking characteristics of dogs is their preference for associating with us and the complex communication and cooperation skills that make them so successful in human communities. Affective communication and bonding are essential components of the human-dog relationship. And there's a recent study out of Adam McClosey's lab by Veronica Konok that indicates how consistently people interpret the emotions of dogs and suggests that people believe that dogs understand human affective states as well. So anthropomorphism is baked into our assessment of dogs' behavior and emotional states. As Vincent Dupré has shown, scientists' beliefs about experimental organisms shape their interactions with those animals. The researchers' belief that space flight was possible animated their expectations of what the dogs could do and their commitment to developing the equipment and systems that would take them to outer space and return them safely. Furthermore, human assumptions about the nature of dogs, about what was going on in their minds and how they felt, shaped how the dogs were handled. They provided a cornerstone of essential human-dog interactions in the laboratory. Of course, Soviet scientists did not say that. What we know about their emotions and their understanding of canine emotion comes via their adaptation of Pavlovian behaviorism to meet the needs of this very complex engineering project. So they got a lot of things from Pavlov, including dogs, right? But also the concept of the chronic experiment and the concept of a surgically modified dog as a kind of biotechnology. But for this discussion, there are two aspects of Pavlov's approach that are key, and they're both somewhat contradictory. The first is his incredibly problematic research on the biological foundations of personality and the use of dogs as models for human behavior. So the space researchers were quite explicit about using dogs as stand-ins for the humans who would follow them. They observed every aspect of individual dogs' behavior. The dogs had names, and how they behaved outside the laboratory, how much they slept, whether they liked to play, who their favorite kennel mates were, how independent they were on walks, their preferences for particular people, food, etc. All of this was documented as evidence of an individual dog's personality. The researchers considered behavior an extremely sensitive indicator of overall well-being. And having having baseline data about a dog's preferences and habits gave them another point for evaluating the impact of stress and recovery from the tests the dogs were subjected to. They knew that dogs whose physiological values returned to normal, but whose behavior changed, they became more reticent or couldn't perform previously conditioned behaviors after a launch or a test, were stressed and or traumatized. And they theorized, obviously, that humans experiencing the conditions of flight might be similarly affected. Also following Pavlov, they identified basic temperaments among the dogs, and they divided the dogs who made it through the initial tests into three groups. The most valuable animals belonged to what they called the quiet category. We would probably say stable. Nearly all of the orbital flight dogs, the satellite dogs, so Laika, Belka, and Strelka, fell in this group. We would probably say they were calm, friendly, even-keeled dogs who were not easily frightened. But how researchers felt about these dogs comes through in this description of Lisichka, a dog who perished when the rocket that was supposed to send her into space exploded on the launch pad. This is her in advance of a centrifuge test. Lisichka is our favorite dog. In her, we find what seems to be an unlikely combination of qualities. She is obedient, she shows initiative, and she also loves life. During experiments, she behaves very attentively and actively. There's nothing unnecessary in her behavior. For example, she never chews at the sensors and instruments. When you first encounter all of these remarkable qualities in this animal with its behavior during experiments, it would seem that nature created Lisichka especially for scientific experiments. But Lisichka is only partially a creation of nature. A big role in the making of experimental animals is played by the patient, loving, and thoughtful attitude of the researchers in training the dogs. So, the people who worked with Lisichka regarded her as a unique individual, one who cooperated with experimenters while also displaying initiative and affective states that people perceived as cheerful and attentive. Her suitability as an experimental organism was partly a function of her individual constitution, but that potential had been called forth and realized by the expectations and care of the investigators. Lisichka's relationships with them were specific to her and secured with the emotional glue of affection and love, according to them. So the second aspect of Pavlov's practice that informed their work was this tension between his stance as a supposedly neutral scientist investigating indifferent natural material and his emotional attachment to experimental subjects. Since Pavlov had used dogs to investigate the workings of human personality and behavior, assumptions about the similarities between dogs and people came easily to the space researchers. At the same time, the dog's role as a friend of humanity and a servant of science validated its use in the laboratory and on the launch pad, But the contradiction between regarding dogs as helpmates, servants, and friends and the compulsion to sacrifice them for science was problematic. These mostly unacknowledged expectations allowed people both to empathize with the dogs in anthropomorphic ways and to distance themselves from animal suffering. Furthermore, they refracted all of this through the prism of Pavlovian behaviorism, which regarded behavior in animals and people as essentially a matter of stimulus and response. So in comparative psychology, dogs were neural systems exemplifying learning processes, not representatives of a species with its own distinctive behaviors and capacities. So thankfully, not only has behaviorism fallen out of favor as a method for understanding humans and dogs, but we also know much more now about the unique sensory and cognitive abilities of dogs and their perceptual world, thanks to the work of ethologists such as Alexander Horowitz and Brian Hare. We might not ever know what it is like to be a dog, but we do understand more about what the world might look like from the dog's perspective. We know that the dog's sensory experience is dominated by its nose. We know that they know us by smell, by appearance, and by behavior, and they are extremely adept at reading our body language. While we struggle to get past anthropomorphism and interpreting what dogs do, dogs understand that we are wired differently than they are. They are attuned to humans in ways that enhance their evolutionary success, including their ability to connect emotionally to people. So, how did this work for them in this particular setting? First of all, it's clear that the dogs sought out and developed relationships with people, and this involved cultivating secondary relationships, so empathy, trust, shame, in both parties. We have many descriptions of dogs behaving in ways that cultivated attachments with humans. Memoirs of the researchers who worked with the dogs abound in descriptions of what individual dogs did and how critical the emotional bonds between individuals were. For example, a physician named Roman Bayevsky was particularly fond of Lisichka, the favorite dog mentioned above, and once when he arrived late for a procedure where he was to implant electrodes under her skin, the normally docile dog began to struggle and panic, resisting the efforts of two lab assistants to restrain her. But when Bayevsky appeared, she immediately calmed down, and this is how Bayevsky recalled what happened next. She looked at me in a way that made me feel terrible. In her gaze, I read offense, surprise, and incomprehension all at the same time. The point was that I had a custom of talking to her and explaining what we were doing. The dog answered trust with trust. And now, here, on the operating table, she turned to me for an explanation of what was going on. I asked the assistants to leave and unfasten the dog. Then I petted Lisichka. I told her that it was necessary and important that she behave quietly. I asked her to lie on her right side. The operation to implant the electrode went quickly. She did not move or twist. The supervising surgeon was satisfied. So, although Lisichka would not survive, in other cases, the affective ties that developed between dogs and researchers provided a bridge to a more ordinary life as a researcher's pet after they finished in the space program. But the emotional constitutions of individual dogs were also crucial to their ability to survive the most arduous and, I think it's fair to say, cruel aspect of this testing regimen, which involved long-term confinement isolated in a small container with limited mobility. These tests, which simulated the conditions of living in space, helped researchers anticipate how space flight would affect living organisms, people and dogs, and how the response of individuals would vary. So a general description of a method that was very complicated and had many more stages than I have time to go into here, but basically in the first phase, they were conditioned to spend several days at a stretch in what was called the tight cell, so the image up there on the left, with minimal human interaction and little or no opportunity to exercise. And once they could endure that while, quote, behaving calmly without any frustration, confusion, self-injury, or damage to the cage, and I will say that damage to the cage and escapes were both very, very common, they moved to the second stage of testing, which was in the hermetic cabin, which is on the right. So this would be a dark, quiet cabin, and for this they had to wear a sanitation suit. They were leashed to the sides of the cabin, hooked up to pulse and respiration monitors, and eating a gelatinous food dispensed from an automatic feeder, and having no interactions with other dogs or people. So this is dogs learning how to use the automatic feeder, and another dog wearing the sanitation equipment. So any social animal would struggle in these conditions, and dogs were no exceptions. People found this difficult as well, although at least they could provide a measure of informed consent. For the dogs, the initial phase of coming to terms with the sensory deprivation and restraint generally followed a path cued up by the primary emotions of curiosity, surprise, and interest, followed by anger, anxiety, fear, as evidenced by whining, scratching, chewing, struggling to escape, barking, howling, panting, with accompanying increases in heartbeat and shallow, rapid respiration. In the next phase, sometime in the first 2 or 3 days, one of three things generally happened. The dog's overall condition deteriorated. They became increasingly agitated and angry, snarling, growling, struggling against the restraints, and refusing to eat or eliminate. They became depressed and shut down, lying motionless, trembling, staring vacantly, or appearing to sleep. Or they found ways to adjust to these conditions without succumbing to despair or emotional breakdown. Dogs who met the following criteria after a 17-day test were considered suitable candidates for orbital flight. They lost less than 20% of their body weight, consumed more than 60% of the daily food ration, had normal urine and stool output, no stress panting, no pathological movements or vocalizations, no sluggishness, no labile or negative emotional sounds, and no evidence of slovenliness, which is a coat condition or stereotypes licking off your fur and stuff. And most importantly, they remained friendly and tractable with people when it was over. So these successful dogs might have barked or howled in the dark, quiet of the capsule out of boredom, but they did so while adjusting their basic life activities, such as eating and defecating, to conditions that ran counter to their natural behavior, while remaining psychologically and physiologically pretty much the same dog they had been before. So to go back to Pavlov once more, in his quest to understand psychiatric abnormalities, Pavlov set out to make dogs neurotic and even break them completely. Trauma and death were inevitable in the space dog program as well, but the researchers had the opposite goal. The goal was not to break the dogs, but to identify those animals and then people who could endure environmental extremes and remain psychologically as well as physiologically intact. Ultimately, for dogs and for humans, individuals had to identify the strategies to survive the challenges presented by long-term sensory deprivation and the loss of social interaction. So, historians have long understood that to make sense of the past, we must attend to the commonalities of human experience and to the unique perspectives and identities of our human subjects. I propose that if we are to understand the crucial role that companion species play in constituting the shared social fabric that is our historical experience, we must also attend to the unique ways those species experience the world and how they move through their lives with us as individuals as well. Acknowledging how dogs experience and try to cope with conditions such as the ones I've just described should prompt us to ask some hard questions about our relationships with them. And recognizing how crucial emotions are to the ties that bind humans to dogs might prompt us to reconsider using them for this kind of scientific research.